Okay, we'll call a meeting. It's a special call work session. And the time was starting was immediately following the special call meeting, which didn't do exactly. We're all here except the mayor. And is there any general announcements from anybody on the council? Okay, education. Dan, would you read the invocation for this?
We just refer to the last one.
We're considering the invocation being read because it can all be the photographic place, especially the people from Kansas. I know they can remember anything. So, with the indulgence of the citizens, we will consider that read. Pledge of Allegiance. John, would you lead us in the Pledge of Allegiance?
It would be my pleasure. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Okay, public comment. Do we have any? Nobody for public comment? Okay.
Tom, just saying, thank you, sir.
Please, if we get some more ammunition. Okay, come on, Brian. No public comment at this time. We'll go right into discussion item D1. Sharon, would you read that for us, please?
Yes, sir. An ordinance for right-of-way protection.
This starts at tab F in your book, by the way, everybody.
Yeah, it's D1, I think.
D1. Oh, it is?
Yep.
No? Close.
Okay, Richard.
Okay, Richard, you're going to tell us all about this. Good. Thank you.
What this is on Permanent Center West and Hammond Drive on the property that's known as the High Street development. And in the course of the streetscape project that was done by DeKalb County and PCID on Permanent Center West, they acquired some slivers of right-of-way. During the course of construction of that project, they moved some driveways around, and some of the slivers they bought were no longer needed for the purpose of maintaining the roads and streets. And the developer, since they're not needed by us, the developer would like to have them back to help with the design of his development. At the same time, there are some additional little slivers that we do need for the driveways that were installed, and also for a deceleration lane on Hammond Drive for a shared driveway between the High Street development and the corporate campus development next door that's in the process of being designed right now. So what this is just a right-of-way swap. It's a land swap where the city is giving up the little slivers of right-of-way that we no longer need, and in return we're getting the little slivers of right-of-way we do need. We're abandoning 3,868 square feet of land, and I believe it's, three or four little tracts, and we're acquiring, Brian, let's see. Do you have what the number is? The one I have printed out has the old one. Wrong number in there. I believe it's a little over 6,000 square feet of right-of-way.
Keep talking, I'll find a way to.
6,215. Yes, square feet. As we do indicate the values of the property, what the state law allows, allows the cities to do, as long as we are getting equal or greater value in return, we're allowed to do this right-of-way swap. There is no money changing hands. It's simply a land transaction. The values are shown to assure that we are getting an equal or greater value in property in return for what we are giving up.
Okay.
Yes. Do we really need the land we're swapping it for? I'd love to get the cash.
The big piece is the deceleration lane, and yes, we do. Because there's a new road that's going to be put in from Hammond Drive. It's almost sits along the city limit between us and Sandy Springs, but it sits between the High Street development and the corporate campus development on the other side, and provides interpartial access between the two. It's part of achieving what we want in the grid system and perimeter center area, and so the deceleration lane is needed, and the right-of-way for that is needed, and would save us having to acquire that land at some point in the future. Yes, sir.
Hammond Drive, I believe, is scheduled to do a major project because of the new interchange going on to 400. How does this, is this going to be affected at all by that improvement to Hammond?
I believe this road is going in, and this right-of-way is factored into that, although all the work on this stretch of Hammond is all preliminary design, and that's a long-range project, so no detailed analysis has been done on what improvements are going to be needed to Hammond. So, and right now that's a more than 5-year out project in the state TIP, which means, you know, it's a long way off from having to develop even a concept of what's going to be needed for right of way at this point.
So I'm way ahead of schedule.
Yes. Yes, sir.
Reading through this, I actually got confused on one very elemental point. Are we trading pieces of property, or are we trading right-of-way? In other words, is actual property changing hands, or are we just giving up our rights to encroach on somebody else's property in exchange for a right to encroach? It wasn't clear to me whether, you know, because, again, we've all got, the city's got rights-of-way rights to our private property. What are we changing here?
The roadway, what we are giving up is land that has been acquired as a public right-of-way for the purpose of operating and maintaining a public roadway.
Okay.
What we've, in the process, we've determined that in what they've requested with the changes that were made in the construction plan, we no longer need these little slivers of land, these little slivers of land to maintain and operate this public roadway because of changes that were made in construction.
Okay, so we're actually trading pieces of property.
We're trading pieces of property.
Okay.
And in return, we're getting land that for the future, or for us to be able to maintain and operate a public right-of-way, which in this case, primarily the deceleration lane, but there's some little slivers around driveways that will help us maintain those. John?
Will that new street that goes north off Hammond for the diesel lane, will that be a public street?
I believe it will be because it's a shared roadway. I'm not absolutely sure of that. I will have to check on that.
Will we then have to then buy that street? I mean, I guess is my point. We're doing right away into a street that...
I believe that one would be, because it's being built by developers, it would be like any street in a new development. It would be dedicated as part of the development conditions to us,
and that
it becomes a public street.
And they then wouldn't donate that land to us anyway?
Possibly, but it gets to be an issue of who ends up building that street. And I think with that shared drive, the drive sits entirely on the corporate campus property, not on the High Street property. So it would be a case there's some, you're dealing with a couple different property owners there.
By the map that I'm looking, it looks like the property line, the county line, goes right down the middle of the road.
Okay.
Richard, can you tell us why somebody is so nice to trade us almost 2-to-1 on the square feet?
I think they're wanting to get these little slivers. I mean, the slivers are, for the most part, inconsequential for the city. I believe it's just they have, within fitting their development plans, they want to have access to be able to put landscaping and other features of their development in these little triangles that we are abandoning. And I believe that's where the benefit for them is, that they're doing this.
Because I'm from the farm music when somebody wants to trade you that, it's kind of, you know, swamp land for a soil,
Well, they see more value in their small slivers for what they want to do than with what they're giving up, what they're willing to give up, okay, because of what they're going to be limited in being able to do in those areas.
Okay. Any other discussion? Okay. That's first read. Okay, item D2. Sharon, would you read that, please?
Yes. An ordinance amending Chapter 23 of the City of Dunwoody Code of Ordinances by creating street light districts.
Okay. Any discussion?
Do we have city report, please? We have staff report.
Richard's a man on that.
What this is, DeKalb County had a street light district policy that they had, that they were operating under, whereas residential neighborhoods could request street lights on their street, and it was a petition process that they had. We are in the process of basically adopting that policy, but in discussion with the city attorney, we didn't see in DeKalb County's ordinances, which we had already adopted, where they had the authority to do what they were doing. And so what this ordinance does is it basically allows the Public Works Department to establish a policy for street light petition for residential districts, establishing those districts, and it allows that the city council has, by resolution, the right to approve those districts before they're implemented. It's basically just cleaning up the ordinance to allow us to do what DeKalb County was apparently doing without ordinance, at least in the opinion of the city attorney.
Jane?
How are the homeowners charged for that kind of thing? Is it by the linear foot on the curb, or is it a house, or?
It's done by the linear, the street front footage is the technical term. But basically, it's allocated so many cents or so many dollars per linear foot frontage. And it's based, each district is allocated a different amount based on the cost of the street lights in that district. So if you're taking a street that might have, let's say, 1,000 feet on it, and if you had a 100-foot lot, you'd be allocated basically the equivalent of 10% of the total cost of the street lights for that, the annual street light cost, of which is the power and the maintenance by doing the power.
Do you think that's a fair way of doing it versus by household?
Usually it is, because street lights is affected by how, because it is the actual lighting itself, and the benefit of the lighting for someone has a more frontage has more benefit by the from the lighting than someone with less frontage.
I just kind of take a page out of Councilman Ross' book here. This is not my idea originally, but I kind of like it, and he reiterated, and that's, I don't know exactly where this all comes in, but on the main routes in the city, someday, he'd like to see it, I'd like to see it, is a uniformity of type of lighting, like, i.e., maybe what is around perimeter at this time. And I think that's one of the things that I think we need to kind of write in there somewhere, that, that is our desire or wish, quote unquote, dependent upon the funding. But, I'm not talking about down in the neighborhoods and that kind of thing, but the main routes,
right. You
would really identify the city, I think. And, you've probably seen those lights over there. I think they look very nice.
They
I
are.
I don't imagine they're much more, if any, expensive than the ones we're putting up anywhere else.
Correct. And just to reiterate, those lights, that policy, those lights are not covered by this policy. This policy is for the residential street lights only. Those lights we pay for as a city ourselves. We pay the maintenance. They're not. We don't allocate that to the homeowners if it's on a main road. Those are covered. There's in the budget. There was actually two separate line items in the budget. One is for what we call highway and street lighting, which is the lighting on the main roads, which the city pays for. And then there's the residential street lighting, which is assessed to the property owners through the street light fee, which there's a corresponding revenue line item that balances that out. So this is covering that residential street light program, the process of where we would add in districts, whether it be a new development or it's an existing neighborhood that does not have street lights that would like street lights.
Jasmine?
Richard, can you tell us if this resolution deals with private streets? I don't see it mentioned one way or the other. And I'm wondering if you can comment as to that, because I believe the DeKalb County goes for only public streets.
DeKalb County goes for public streets. This would we could set that in the policy, and that's a decision we would have to make as a city. And if the we would have to look at the assessment ability, whether we could bring in a private street into this, but that we could set that up in the actual policy itself.
But as far as the resolution that you have in front of us tonight, how does it read?
Streetlights within their neighborhood, the public, there is established a streetlight district program whereas eligible residential areas may petition the city to authorize installation of streetlights within their neighborhood. And the Public Works Department shall create and maintain a policy of establishing a streetlight district. It does not distinguish public. This ordinance does not distinguish public road versus private road.
You know, the Mayor Pro Tem's point about type of lighting. You're not talking about lighting here on a telephone pole or anything. You're talking about a light that's on a pole that's just got a light bulb at the top of it, right?
It would be both. Generally, the way the program works right now with DeKalb County and what we're looking at adopting is in neighborhoods that have overhead power lines, which means they have the existing power poles, those neighborhoods would generally get the lights that attach to the power poles. Part of that's a cost factor because those Georgia Power basically installs those for free or they're built into the annual cost. In neighborhoods, and this affects mostly the newer neighborhoods that have underground power, they are required, there is no poles to put those streetlights on, so they're required to put the poles in there. The way the policy we're looking at, the DeKalb County has a policy and the way we're looking at adopting it is the neighborhood has to purchase, basically pay for those poles up front. So there is a significant cost to the neighborhood resident up front. You always have the option for those neighborhoods that have overhead power for going to the decorative poles, but you're talking about an added upfront cost in there to the neighborhood. And that's if the neighborhood was willing to take on that upfront cost, I think as a city we would be more than willing to do that, but it's kind of understood that that's a cost to the residents.
But I think to Mayor Pro Tem's point here, I think it would be a good thing for us to start to do to get some standardization up into our community. Otherwise, you're going to have a wooden pole in one community, you're going to have another one of a different kind in another.
In the way it is right now, Georgia Power has basically two pole types.
Right,
there is standards that they choose from, and we can work with them as to developing which pole types we want to put in there. That's a matter of working with Georgia Power to develop which the standard pole type for the city.
Richard, a couple months ago, you were I forwarded you an email regarding a request for a street light. It was around the time of the home invasion. I believe that is an underground power grid. It seems like a good time to ask you that question.
Yes.
Give me an update, if you could. Is it related to that in the sense of what happened with that? We put in a request for a street light. How does that tie to this policy, I guess, is my question.
Well, this policy allows us to address that request. We have not received a formal request from the neighborhood for the streetlights. It was reiterated that it would be a good idea, but we have not received a formal request. If we had received a formal request, our legal authority to be able to implement the policy would have been in question. What this will do is it will basically allow us to establish a policy so that we can process that request for a streetlight district and then bring it to the council for approval.
Thank you for clarifying.
Just a point that I was just thinking about, brought up private streets, I don't know how many there are. There's not very many areas, I think, in Dunwoody that does not already have streetlights of some kind, is it?
Correct. Most of this is going to be for infill. This policy will also apply to new developments as well. So this will allow us to establish a policy when a new development comes in, and we actually have four or five that are in various states of process. There's actually one later on the agenda today, the first one we're addressing. This is mainly going to impact new developments that are coming in as well. Although in the case of what Councilman Hennigan, the one in Councilwoman Bosner, had said to me, there is several neighborhoods, especially particularly on Womack, that do not have streetlights on them, that there may be a need for them if the neighbors so wish to choose to do that. So there are some streets, but you are correct that majority of the city residential streets in the city already have street lighting of some sort or another.
And just to clarify one other question, I had no idea. I lived on Roberts Road and I had a streetlight in front of me. I I'm not assessed on my taxes on that.
Depends on which part of Roberts Road. There are, if the homes, if there are parts like Womack is a good example. I'm more familiar with Womack than with Roberts. From, more or less from the, where the new elementary school is being built, about that location, up to Chamblee-Dunwoody, most of that area, with the exception of the high school, is residential homes fronting on Womack Road. That section of Womack is a considered a residential streetlight district, and the homeowners on that stretch of Womack are assessed on their tax bill for streetlights. From the side of the new elementary school down to Tilly Mill Road, you have the various schools in the neighborhoods that back up to it. That is not considered a streetlight district. That's considered a highway lighting district, which the city is responsible for paying for the streetlights in those areas. And so I assume Roberts Drive, we could look at the specific areas, but I'm assuming Roberts Drive will be the same way, depending on the nature of the road at that various point.
The streetlight district, from what I understand, our cost on this is about $50,000 a year. I think that's what the county told us, that they felt the charges were done with the streetlight district.
For the highway lighting?
For the lights that it's going to be paid for by Dunwoody.
I believe it's actually a little bit higher. I don't have the budget numbers in front of me, but I think we budgeted something 60, higher 67. Than that. 67?
Yeah.
For that.
Dr. Bell told us it's about $50,000.
Yeah. It's actually a little bit higher than that, and we're working with Georgia Power now to make sure we have an accurate inventory of what we're paying for and going through those. That is right now as well with Georgia Power. And same on the residential streetlight district. We're going through and checking the streets and confirming our inventory with Georgia Power's inventory to make sure we're paying for what's out there and we're not paying for things that aren't out there.
When we create a streetlight district, mm-hmm. and we assess the homes for the cost of that lighting, when we get a request to add a streetlight to an existing district,
yes.
how does that work in terms of the assessment? Do you just assess everybody more? Do you assess the house on either side? How do you add to an existing one?
It gets added to the streetlight district, and some of that is an issue with Georgia Power of how much, whether we have to change the assessment on an annual, and we can change a particular assessment on an annual basis, and it will impact depending on how many streetlights we're adding and what the how many homes are in that district. Obviously, if there's a large number of homes in the district and we're adding one light, more often than not, we're not going to change the assessment because the cost factor is negligible. If you had a small district of, let's say, 5 or 6 homes, we were adding a light in there, that could add some cost to it. We take it on a district-by-district, case-by-case basis okay. of whether an adjustment to the assessment needs to be made.
Okay, thank you.
Any other discussion? It's a first read. Thank you very much, Richard. Sharon, would you read these three, please?
Chapter 9, ethics.
Okay, discussion, this is the first read on amendments to they are marked in here on your lines in and lined out. Ryan?
Yes, thank you. Reason why amendment that being proposed. There was a concern about certain organizations being able to serve on city boards the way it was previously written. It could be interpreted that could narrowly be prohibited as a conflict. This reduces that level of conflict down to closer to what the state law, state mandates at the bare minimum.
So all the changes in this document were basically around what you were just saying?
Almost all of them were. There was one that Debbie Ross pointed out that was not. That was the one that states, if anyone knows about a ethics violation, that is not, if an ethics violation is not reported, One of the council members suggested that that might be removed. So we decided to just address the law.
Okay, so that's on page 12, the one you were just mentioning. And what about page 16, number 6? Was that also asked by a council member, or was that part of the initial change?
Oh, no, no, no. It's right back in the second one. That was asked when we were initially adopted, because we were supposed to have gotten rid of the received gifts into an actual gift. And that was overlooked during that time. We thought we had gotten rid of all the exceptions of a gift. We had paid a hard $400 for the gift. And that one was overlooked from the previous one. So that was not specifically asked by council member this time, but it was from the previous time.
Okay.
Just the intent of doing this, the reason for doing this, is, I mean, to be more specific, you didn't name the organization, but the BHA is the organization you're talking about. And the committees that we're talking about are the zoning committees. And probably one of the things that Dunwoody has been blessed the most for was having people who are so knowledgeable about zoning and about land planning and things that other cities would wish that they had that kind of capability to have. And the individuals that serve on these boards, I think we're very fortunate to have people on the board. Personally, other than the fact that the DHA, as the name would imply, speaks primarily to the homeowners and not to the business owners, I think the objectives of the organization certainly is consistent with what our board's objectives are in terms of the intent of the EHA has been for the 30 years that I've been aware of it. Do you really see a conflict between those two organizations, really?
You're talking about the state mandates under the conflicts provisions under the zoning laws basically prohibits a pecuniary interest, personal pecuniary interest in the matter, and that's what it mandates, so that's the floor. And that is what this thing is more, the current amendment is designed to do, is to replace that. The way this was written previously was if there was a conflict, and there is, it could be a conflict because they don't represent the whole, that would be a conflict, could be interpreted as a conflict the way it was previously written. So this is getting that and making it closer to what the minimum state law is. And that's prohibiting a pecuniary interest, not just an interest representing another organization or being in another organization.
But the fact that the DHA represents the whole of the community, not just the individual, right? Most of the people on that committee, I would say, probably are homeowners. How do we distinguish between somebody who's a DHA member and a person that's on that committee that's just a homeowner? It seems to me like we're kind of hitting.
Well, that's why this is being amended, to allow people who are in this organization that if you are on an organization, you are now the director of that board organization, you have to represent that organization, and that would be in a conflict with being on the board. You've now eliminated those prohibitions, and now the region is closer to what you're stating now. Is that the DHA representing board orders, homeowners in general, is not too different than any other homeowner in any city, except this thing had a provision in it that if you were on an organization, you basically owed allegiance to that organization, and therefore if there was, the organization would take a stance and brought it in front, that would be a conflict. And now we've eliminated those provisions.
So the alternatives were to resign from the DHA and be on the committee or not be on the committee.
That's correct. The way it was previously written, correct. Before amendment.
Any other discussion?
Yeah. This is not directed at Brian, because I think I understand what he said, but it's a comment on the intent. I read through this thing, I don't know, 6 or 8 times over the weekend, trying to decide what I thought about it. And I'm worried about making this change, guys. And I'm worried for a couple of reasons. First of all, I think it's entirely possible that we will have cases where the city council will decide to go a different way than what the DHA has recommended in terms of a land use or a zoning decision. And I can't imagine that scenario with a board that's even 30% intermixed. Our interests and the DHA's interests are not identical. 40% of the people we represent live in apartments. And the DHA doesn't represent them, doesn't try to, doesn't claim to. In fact, they're quasi-antagonistic. It strikes me as a mistake to think that somebody can sit on the DHA board and represent those interests and sit on the Planning Commission or the Zoning Board of Appeals and represent our interest and not put themselves in a position where they've got two different organizations with differing interests and be in conflict. I hate to say this, but I think that we are blessed by having had the DHA. They have done a marvelous job protecting our interests, and many of those people on the DHA board are now taking positions on our boards. I think they need to make a decision as to which board they want to serve on, and because the agendas are not identical. And I think this is a mistake. I think, as much as it pains me, and I've been active in DHA for many, many years, I don't think it's appropriate. I think we do compromise the ethics of our boards by having people serve in leadership positions on both. So for what it's worth, that's my spiel.
Any other discussion? John.
I've never been a member of the Dunwoody Homeowners Association board, though I don't think I've missed a meeting in the last 2 years. Dunwoody Homeowners Association, as far as I can tell, has done great work. They have served our community well. The way I see the board working is that there's a small group of people who serve on the zoning planning type activities of the DHA. And there may be times in which those people, when if they're dealing with a issue on the DHA and then had to serve on our board, there would be a conflict. I can understand that. The problem is that the DHA board is about 40, 50 people. And I don't believe all 40 or 50 people on the DHA board are making decisions based on the zoning and land use. They are sitting in the meeting, and for the most part, there's very little controversy because the three or four zoning people have done all the work. So I would hope that if the three or four people that had a specific item in front of them, that they would then recluse themselves from any action sitting on a city board. But yet the other Dunwoody Homeowner Association board members really have no conflict because they didn't have a dog in the fight to begin with. That's the way I say to see the DHA working. I think this change fixes that for the most part. But again, if there is going to be somebody who is going to make a monumental decision and influence the DHA and then serve on our board, I believe that's wrong. Does this now leave that open to scrutiny that person may have done something wrong? That may be a loophole that we're leaving ourselves open to.
What this does, it prohibits someone who has a direct pecuniary interest in or whatever the process is. If they don't have that interest, it is now allowed. Does that answer the question? So if they don't have a direct pecuniary interest person, they can actually do it and sit on both boards and make those determinations. I think that raises itself, but this is not possible.
Correct.
It kind of falls under the same thing we do. You know, like Robert, when you had to excuse yourself from the bank discussion, you know, you had a direct financial interest in the company, and I think that's the thing. I think that's where it comes in. What is the financial enhancement for someone serving on the DHA and serving on this board? If they're, you know, they don't have a piece of property, they don't have a piece of property around there. I think we can also maybe include the fact that maybe if a member is on there and feels that they have a conflict of interest, then they should excuse themselves.
They can always exclude themselves if they perceive or state they have a conflict. But if they don't have a direct pecuniary interest in the matter, they don't have a mandated conflict.
Both the planning as well as the appeal board, they both have a majority DHA members, right?
I don't recall.
Of the seven, I know the zoning board within that category. I just have a general comment that I'd like to make, and it's the only thing I have to add to this discussion. You said that what we're taking this to is to a minimum that meets the state requirements and ethics.
This is not quite at the minimum. This is still higher than the minimum.
It's not as strong as it was. Okay? What I don't want us to get into a habit of doing is every time that we run up on a crossroad that we don't know the answer to, we make the changes that take us to that maybe a little bit higher standard. I think we ought to keep the ethics code, which has been, I think, debated very much on this panel up here. But I think we ought to make sure that if we make this change, that we don't make this a habit, that we as a council, every time we have something that comes up, well, we can work around that by being a little bit better than the state, but not as good as we were.
One of the things I believe we're lining out here is the appearance of conflict. I believe it might be regarding gifts and not so much so on the board issue. But the appearance of conflict, the Dunwoody Homeowners Association named all elected officials as ex officio members of the DHA board. I'm not sure we really accepted those positions, but we were named to them. That alone could be considered a conflict. I'm going to be speaking or introducing the city manager tomorrow at a meeting in my neighborhood. I was named the ex officio for the Dunwoody North Civic Association. I've already told my board that I will be resigning and not accepting that ex officio position. How does that affect our duties here? How does ex officio members of the DHA as city council members affect the situation of the law which we have in front of us?
Okay, previously or in this, after this amendment?
Let's go after.
After this amendment, there would not be a conflict. Previously, if you are a voting ex officio member, that could very well be a conflict.
Right. Ex officio and voting, they're mutually exclusive, right?
No, not necessarily. You can have ex officio members who are voting, and you can have ex officio veterans non-voting. Okay. Against the bylaws, whether or not. Gotcha. Robert's rules, if it's not specified, states for non-voting.
Right, you're typically not voting.
If you're an ex officio non-voting member, I would say that I wouldn't have an interest in that. Would be a different story.
Advisory.
One more item. We have an ethics board. I don't believe they've met as of yet. They have not met? Some of the duties of the board are to establish a process for evaluating significant aspects of the administration and implementation of this chapter. Have we thought of running these changes past that ethics board in which we've all named members?
We have not done so. Certainly can be done, but they haven't been called.
Another part, it says it makes recommendations to the mayor and city council of legislative or administrative actions regarding the city's policies and practices. By passing this, if we were to pass this next week, would we be in violation of our own ordinances?
I would assume not. You've got the power to violate, to make your own policies.
Okay, thank you.
I might suggest to us that John's maybe given us a good way to approach this. Perhaps we ought to ask the folks we selected for the ethics board to look at this and make a recommendation. You know, they've got some objectivity. None of them is serving on the DHA board, I don't think. None of them is on any of these other boards. They have a little distance. Maybe it's a better approach to give them an opportunity to tell us what they think.
And at least one of those board members I'm aware of helped us in the drafting of the ethics code, and he happens to be a seasoned both corporate as well as government ethics attorney.
Any other discussion?
I'm done.
Okay. Thank you, Brett.
Okay, item G4,
Sheriff. An ordinance to adopt and approve Chapter 20, Assemblages and Public Places, and provides for citizen and identification in the set of ordinances for the City of Dunwoody, Georgia, to be referenced in the future of Chapter 20, Assemblages and Public Places, as attached hereto and incorporated herein.
Okay. This is Chapter 20. It's in your book there, folks. In Camp 4. I've got a couple things that I'd like to say, but then I'll wait until everybody else says it.
Well, it looks like Warren's getting ready to give us some.
Oh, Warren's going to jump in. Okay, Warren, jump in.
Mayor, members of council, the ordinance that you have in front of you, we have made several changes to it, some which are minor, capitalization, some that are somewhat significant. There are a few that I would like to point out. Specifically, and I also included a flow chart at the request of council that I didn't want to be able to answer the questions that y'all might have. I believe the major changes that I'd like to point out specifically is on page 8 and 12, section 5 permit fees, subsection G. I'll give you a second. What we've done with this is make a recommendation that the permit review fee requirement would be excused and waived by the city, but that these organizations, which are 501c3 under the IRS, the original ordinance read that they were waived from all fees. So what this entails is that there are two separate elements to the fee, the ordinance. One is the review fee that staff takes the time over, course of days for review, and we charge for that service a nominal fee. The second element, which is more important, is that we are evaluating part of our review process any direct cost associated with the event of the assemblage. This section of waiving for any 501c3, there's certainly going to be instances where an organization not associated with the City of Dunwoody wants to use, part of a public park, they happen to be a 501c3, and the direct cost may involve the use of police officers, other equipment, and the use of our public works time, which could have a significant cost to the city. This otherwise written would waive that, our ability to recoup those direct costs.
Yeah.
What we've also put in is another provision within that sentence that says that those organizations are not exempt from those fees within the city's direct cost, except that there are such cases where it may be waived by the city manager if in his or her reasonable discretion the event benefits the community at large. And that those organizations would still be required to pay a bond, but I have the ability to go ahead and waive those direct costs. And there will be instances in the future where there is an event that is synonymous with the City of Dunwoody that benefits the entire community, where we are going to provide significant resources. And the July 4th parade is the one that kind of comes to my mind initially, where it's likely that we're going to have possibly two dozen police officers on duty that day. They're going to be overtime, some of them. And I don't know that that's necessarily something the city wants to stick to whichever organization happens to file for the permit for that event. So in the way the analysis works, to not be arbitrary and capricious, we put the full benefit of the community. So if there is an event that focuses on a very small group in a certain part of the city, we don't have to waive that. But if there is an event that's clearly the largest parade in the state of Georgia, or something similar to that, we would have the right to waive those fees. So I wanted to point that section out specifically. Also, if you'll turn, please, right at the of page 12 and 12 on the other side, is a special event permitted workflow. This was a specific request to council to look at what kind of process there would be for the major events that we know of, including Lemonade Days, the bicycle ride, July 4th parade, and the light up Dunwoody. And this gives you an idea of the
workflow, we just said it would take a maximum 9-day period from the time the applicant submits their application until the time that we go ahead they can reasonably hold the event. We are in the ordinance given up to 15 days, I believe, for the review period. And this shows a 9-day work period. And basically what happens is the applicant brings in their the form that we would create. They would apply for this administrative permit. The permit would go through a review process through the various departments, depending on the scope of the event and the specifics. It may go through the development of public works, especially the police department. And what those departments are assigned to do is to assess the event, determine what expenses we would have associated with, or what needs that event may have from a public safety standpoint, from the impact on the transportation network, plus parks and public places. There is also a requirement for certain events for the fire department to review them for the life safety code. So that is an added time into the process where the fire department has to be brought in. Obviously, it's not a city fire department, so we have a little bit less control over that process, but good working relationship with the fire marshal's office. And then at that point, once all of it's been reviewed by the various parties, the finance administration section will handle the permit from that point forward, finalizing the exact cost, assessing that to the applicant, and then issuing the permit. And then I actually, the person or my designee, sign the permit for these types of events. Excuse me. And we estimate, so in the worst case scenario, about a 9-day process, some of them will be very simple, and we'll be much shorter than that. Be happy to answer any questions that you have.
Just a couple of things. One, being involved in lemonade days for the past X number of years, what we've done in the past, and we didn't expect the county to pay the entire amount for the police security aspect of it. And what we did with DeKalb County was we paid half of it in DeKalb County, and we had off-duty policemen that performed those duties, and DeKalb County provided the other half of the requirements at no cost to the event. So there was a sharing of the cost there. With respect to that event also, we invited the fire department there, and thanks to that Wingate, we got the entire DeKalb County Fire Department, I think, in Brooklyn from time to time. We had more trucks there than they had in the entire county. So we had good fire protection out there. We thought pretty good. So 9 days in advance is what we have to have, you think?
On page 6, isn't a special event needed 60 days in advance? So, lemonade days, you got to get that in there. Difference between assemblages and public and special events? Wasn't there different time frames for one versus the other?
Oh, yeah.
How many days would be a special event?
That's it.
Section 2, 1.
That's a special event.
Yeah.
Section 2, Article 2, permit, Section 2 application.
But that's a different section.
But that doesn't apply to a special event.
Mayor Protem. I think the issue was that the 60 days allowed time for appeal and review of the appeal. Right. The reason for the long period was if you took your time in turning them down, they still had time to come to us, which was the reason, I think, for the 60 days. It was because of the appeals process.
I want to make sure, being this is not a voting meeting, that there's no conflict, and to say this is clearly, unless I'm reading it out of context, Article 2, Section 2 of the application, it's saying at least 15, but not more than 60 days prior to the planned event, and then the other section says 60 days. So when did the assemblage went to the event?
Exactly right.
Is there a distinction in the definitions?
Yes.
11 days would be a special event.
That's 9 days. Well, we have more than 1 day or uses the roadways, it's a special event.
Right. I think, as I'm thinking about on the fly, which is those terrible, I think the 60 days makes some sense because the length of when you know you've got a special event, it's usually got a little bit. Different parties. The other thing I would possibly recommend to council is that, being that you'll be enacting this ordinance this year later in the game than you know normally, and if the ordinance was in effect, the groups that are already having special events, we may want to put some sort of provision in there that waives that 60-day requirement for the 12 months following the enactment of the ordinance, and that will give them time if there is a special event that is coming up. Sooner than later, we can get them. We don't have to hold them up to that requirement. That's
fair. John?
I just saw one item on page 4H. The fact that there's no, you're not allowed to demonstrate at City Hall past 5 p.m. And I'm just wondering if that would be also relevant to the days in which we're having council meetings.
You know any demonstrators?
Well, no, I'm just asking. Does our building know that they're open to demonstrations between 9 to 5?
Yeah. We have a gym.
And I was just wondering if there is, are we limiting their, since we're meeting, I guess is my point.
Again, I'm on the fly, I'll try this one. I think the lease that we've signed only encompasses the square footage inside the building, and we have no right to any property outside of our doors, so that would be an issue between private property owner and how if it affects the ordinance at all, which I don't think it does, because private property is a separate issue altogether.
Okay. See something else.
I guess we can just call our landlord.
I just went through a few things that I did. On page 2 there, Article 2, Section 2, 1, down there, it said, city manager shall act upon application within 10 days of the receipt of the complete application. A person may make emergency application to the city clerk if an unforeseen circumstance requires. I went back in a couple of minutes, it says the city manager shall have discretion to determine if an emergency exists. I was wondering if the application shouldn't be going to the city manager there. To maintain consistency throughout the document.
No, I think the city clerk's the appropriate person because they are the kind of taker of all official documents and also the holder of those documents. So that when somebody files something with the city clerk, it's an official transfer of paperwork from that person to the city.
Okay.
I think it'd be appropriate.
Section 5 over there. Talking about, the 501 through C, we discussed that real well. I don't think we really need to get into that anymore. I think that's probably clarifies everything there as far as, the 501 through C's and what they have to pay and with the possibility that you can exempt them from payment. So I'll scratch that out. Parade 6. Section 6 on the parade. The one that got me right away is, and I thought somewhere in here I read it, so maybe somebody can help me out.
that things like parades were exempt or something from some of the...
Page 1.
Earlier in the document. Where's
section,
that, John?
Page 1, section 3. Well, it's on... Yeah, page 10.
It's under exceptions there?
Correct. Neighborhood parades.
Okay. That's is the 4th of July parade considered, quote-unquote, a neighborhood parade?
No. It goes outside of the subdivision.
Yeah.
Okay, so that... And I get back over here to the liability, if I were at the discretion of the city, that's, I guess, us, prior to the issuance of a permit, the producer shall provide proof to the city of comprehensive liability insurance. If that is, going to be assessed to the 4th of July parade committee, that could become a rather large expense. I don't know, Pam's not here, but maybe Bev knows or somebody. I don't know if that's ever been required to pass by the county or not, but that was one of the things. We don't want to impede the biggest 4th of July parade in the state nowadays, So can you help me out on that one, Warren, where we...
Sure. I think that what we can do on that is look at... I don't know if there's an insurance agent in the house, but just to see what the cost of being an additional insured to provide that insurance. I don't know what the cost would that be. We can take a look at that. Mm-hmm. Just determine how big of a business it would be. But I think it's probably worth it from the city's perspective for the applicant to have insurance. The parade is not going to be the only person that's going to be having events, and there may be other ones where they're doing something in one of our parks, and we very much want to have that liability insurance, and they need to pay for it.
Okay. On section 6, wait a minute, let me go to section 7 real quick. It talks about the vendors will have proof of approval by the county health department. What if the vendor is not from our county? I'm just wondering, does he have to have, does he come to DeKalb County and get that proof, or can he, I presume it says proof from the county's health department and then DeKalb County?
Yeah, my understanding is that if the event is being held in DeKalb County, that DeKalb County would have the authority to regulate the situation.
Yeah.
It's kind of traveling type thing, and approval to DeKalb County.
So if somebody comes from another county, they have to go to DeKalb County and get the proof of whatever they have to have here?
That's my understanding, but I'm going to confirm that.
Okay, because I'm thinking about taking vendors is a thing.
It's not private property.
Yeah, that's indoor. That's,
oh, that's
right.
That's all right. That's private. But it wasn't a couple years ago.
I can tell you how it's handled by DeKalb County, because we have food vendors and lemonade days. And they pretty much just turn their head the other way. That's
and section 10, 2B there, where it's on the top of the page of page 11. That we should have something there about the DeKalb County Fire Chief or designee. We scratched out the city.
I think the reason we put a fire chief in there without a designation is that the ordinance is going to stand for a long period of time, and in the future there may be a possibility that we can have a Dunwoody fire chief. I think it's pretty good.
I can also add to that, if you look at chapter 1, and I know you may not remember how chapter 1 is written, but we would define all the words. When we define the chief of the fire department, we define it as Cap County and/or city and/or other designee in the city's fire department. So you put fire chief, if you just go back to that definition.
Thanks, Lenny, for helping me out there. I appreciate all the help you put here. Okay, that's about all I got. Adrian?
Any vendor serving alcoholic beverages is required to have a license. Will they be required if they're not a licensed vendor in Dunwoody? can get a separate alcohol license.
I think my understanding was that was that they have to have a license somewhere. Is that correct, right?
Well, we do have a special event alcohol permit right. that we'll have to get right. if they don't already have a permit to permit to pour alcohol. In the city of Dunwoody, catering companies will have catering and alcohol permits. They don't already have that, they'll have to get a special event.
Okay. And another question I had, this just kind of jumped out at me. Page 5 as well. Special events, it says by the way you didn't have special events, but one of the things that are excluded are garage sales, lawn sales, runner sales, flea market sales. These are all excluded from this ordinance, but that means that somebody could have a flea market set up in their yard every Saturday, or every Saturday and every other Sunday, because of six days in a 30-day consecutive period of time. They're not.
This ordinance is not public property. So they try to tend to have a garage sale on the middle of the street as opposed to in their driveway. If they want to have a garage sale within their driveway or their lawn, then this ordinance doesn't cover that activity.
Right, so somebody can have one every.
Yeah, I don't know if there's another ordinance that handles the garage sales.
We don't have one currently.
Okay. I've seen the municipal ordinance.
Bicycle runs, it's
frequency,
the bicycle ride.
Any other discussion on this one?
You get into a business.
Okay. I'll throw one more thing.
You're doing it every day. Think the business is not, related to the having own home.
There's one. One accepted assemblage, which happens in Dunwoody numerous times over the summer, which is totally accepted, and that's neighborhood swim meets. Neighborhood swim meets tie up neighborhood parking like you wouldn't believe if they're not organized well. They're totally accepted from here, which is fine. I have no problem with. But I want to make sure that the police chief is aware of the safety issue when it comes to the neighborhoods of parking on both sides, 300 cars all merging into one little neighborhood. You might get a feel for that tomorrow night. But it is something that a police department may want to be aware of. It's a public assemblage. It's totally accepted. But there's a safety issue involved with it. So I just want to make it aware, you're aware of it.
Speaking of safety issue, I think you're related to is getting a fire vehicle down the street.
That's correct.
Okay. I wonder if you can make a few of those changes and bring us out to the next meeting. Those things we don't need to change, right? Those ones that we brought up that we said we're looking at, we'll do that, we'll be happy. Any other discussion? Let's move on to D5. Sharon, would you read that kind of D5 for us?
Discussion on establishing a street light district on Boxwood Place.
Okay. Is Richard still
here? He's ready.
He's over there.
Adrian's so tall, I can't see over there. Okay.
This is just related back to our discussion on the street lights. This is one of the districts that have been in process with DeKalb County. Prior to the city becoming a city, and it's now we've inherited it, and this is one where the developer has paid the money to Georgia Power already for the actual street lights. He's already got a final plat. He's actually already got building permits for homes in the neighborhood and wants to move forward with the street light construction. Everything is, from his standpoint, is in order as far as he has the proper petitions, and he's been proper. He's paid Georgia Power, so it's just a matter of all Georgia Power is waiting for us to do is adopt the resolution to adopt the district so they can go ahead with the installation of the street.
Any questions, members? Okay, see you
now. I'll just make a note that this is a public street, that it's not a private street, and so
I went and verified that.
It is.
Yeah, what is attached? What is attached to the site plan? We're working to get what will be hopefully fit in the resolution next week will be the actual monitor plaque, which will be attached.
Okay. Okay. Any other? See, no more discussion. We'll move right on to number 6. Aaron.
Discussion of a memorandum of understanding (MOU) with the Georgia Department of Transportation for the city to become the sponsor of the Dunwoody Village UT project.
Okay. As most of you are aware, I guess I don't know how long ago. I guess several months ago, the Georgia Department of Transportation awarded a TE grant, Transportation Enhancement Grant, to for the Dunwoody Village pedestrian streetscape improvements. At the time of the initial application, we weren't a city, and DeKalb was something that DeKalb County had been the initial sponsor of. And I believe Mayor Wright was one of the key people involved in getting this TE grant put together. So at now we're at the point of needing to finalize the sponsorship of it, and because we are now a city, it's the desire of the city, it's been expressed to be the desire of the city to be the sponsoring agency of this TE grant so that we have control over the project as opposed to DeKalb County having control of the project or DeKalb County having involvement in the project, Dunwoody and Georgia DOT project. What's before us is a memorandum of understanding, basically the contract that we're signing with Georgia DOT that outlines the conditions that we must adhere to as a sponsoring organization in order to receive this grant money from Georgia DOT. The grant is in the amount of $500,000 for this project. One of the conditions is that we match, the $500,000 is 80% of the total funding. We have to come up with the other 20% of the total funding, which comes out to $125,000. So it's basically committing the city to $125,000 commitment in order to receive this $500,000 grant from the state.
Okay, discussion.
Are we going to have control over how the parkway is actually going to be modified? I mean, it's got 4 lanes, 2 on each side now. It's a speedway through there.
Yes.
I think the thinking is we're going to be taking that maybe to a 2-lane highway, taking away one of the lanes and making it more bicyclable, walkable, safer.
That's the initial concept. What we would do once we get this memorandum of understanding in place, if it is agreed to, is we can go out and hire a design consultant to do the actual design of the road, take the input from what was in the original grant, combine that with further feedback from the citizen, go through the Georgia DOT process to develop plans, and I believe that is the intent, is to make it Dunwoody Village Parkway more walkable, bikeable, roadway instead of the 4-lane divided roadway it is now.
Richard, correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe there's another option on the table whereby we could take the money, the 20%, and take it off the top. Is there another option instead of us paying the 160, where we would just get less money up front?
No, not in this.
Not on this one.
Not on this one.
20%.
Okay.
It's a commitment. It's an 80-20 split between the state and the local, and so. Yeah, there's no option for reducing it.
Yeah, the idea is that the city pays for the design and engineering and right-of-way acquisition, and the state pays for the construction.
Right. In that, yes, that 20%, that $125,000 commitment, the amount we pay towards a design consultant and any right-of-way acquisition can go towards that.
Can go towards that.
So it's not solely construction money on top of design fee. That includes the design fee in there.
Thanks.
Richard, what are the timelines on this? When does this grant go yet?
The reading in the memorandum of understanding is 2 years from the award date. Now, one of the things is we have to get what was the actual award date, because DeKalb County has been sitting on this for probably 5 or 6 months already, so we may already be 5 or 6 months into our timeline. But I'm trying to get some clarification from Georgia DOT on that. as to when the actual award date was and when the actual clock starts for us. But it's, we have to let the project to construction within 2 years of the award date is the way the language in the memorandum of understanding is.
When do we actually have to have the money? When construction starts?
Well,
we have to have that to show good faith to the state to get the others to $500,000
anyway. We would have to actually show that we, in order to get to the point of getting the $500,000, which is construction money, we would have to have a design that meets their standards, and we would have to, that's when we're going to have to pay for that design. So that's where the upfront cost is going to be to hire a design consultant to do the design work and generate the set of plans for the project.
$500,000 doesn't sound like a lot to me.
It's not, and I know from the information I have received that the initial concept in the grant application, the total project cost was $1.3 million. The award was $500,000. So one of the jobs of the design consultant is to take that $1.3 million plan and shrink it down to a $600,000 plan project. And there is some ways of doing that. And I've discussed it with Warren and Mayor Wright already, and there are some ideas out there that it is possible to be done. We might have to scale back, maybe doing one side of the road and not both sides of the road. There are some options there that can be explored to scale back the project and to make it, to make it effective and make it an effective project. Obviously, we're not going to be able to do everything that was initially intended to do, but we can definitely put this money towards improving that area.
I guess my last question, and then I'll get off the poll here. Is this budgeted? Where are we going to come up with $125,000?
We have a budget item, line item for $300,000 for capital improvements, and so the $125,000 can come out of that. $300,000 capital.
Additionally, there's also a very strong possibility that even if we sign the MOU next week, based on the amount of reviews and that the state has to do as you go through this process before we are certified for construction, it will be, if we are lucky, 2010. Some of these projects exceed most people's lifetimes, so this one will be much...
In my case, there may not be too darn long.
I'm not predicting it's a lifetime. The other thing to consider on this project, which is from an optimistic standpoint, is that there really is no right-of-way acquisition, being that most of the work that we're thinking is going to happen will be within existing right-of-way. The amount of time that goes into this process is shortened considerably from other projects that I've done under the TE grant, so I think it's realistic that within a two-year period, we can design this, get all the approvals from state and federal government, and move forward with construction. But I wouldn't anticipate that $125,000 will be all needed this year.
Is that $500,000 applicable? Let's suppose that for some reason, we don't know about today, in the next 2 years, we decide we don't want to parkway the way we've talked about tonight. Is that $500,000 transferable to another project?
My understanding of TE grants is no, it's not. We can use it in the Dunwoody Village Parkway corridor, and we might have some leeway to vary from our original concept, although the nature of transportation enhancement projects, they tend to go towards streetscape, bike, and pedestrian. So the essence of the grant that we applied for was streetscape, bike, and pedestrian improvements in the Dunwoody Village Parkway corridor. So if we're going to do something different from that, we may not be eligible for that grant money to come to us. TE grants they're wonderful, but they can be very restrictive. They are fairly restrictive grants.
Well, we talked about earlier in D1 above, when we were talking about that easement on the Animal Drive.
Mm-hmm.
It was $150,000 or so floating around in that deal. Maybe that'd be a better thing for us to do, is get the cash there and apply it to this project, as opposed to that little term that you're trying to put in.
You might have resistance to the developer to do anything if you did that, but that's another issue.
Okay. Any other discussion? Is there somewhere along the line a map or something kind of like we've got on D1 up there that shows this a little bit?
There is the maps that were in the original application, get those provided to the council. We can attach the original, and we, I apologize for not having that done so for this, but we can't attach the original grant application. The boundaries, Councilman Ardrey, it's Dunwoody Village Parkway from Mount Vernon to Shandon Dunwoody, Red Apple, is that correct? Yeah, and there actually, in the original grant application, there was proposed to be some streetscape work on Mount Vernon and Shandley Dunwoody. So that certainly has to be scaled back. Yes, yes.
Okay. Any other discussion? Okay, you'll have all that for us at the next meeting?
Yeah, that'll be in the packets for that came up this week. We'll make sure that gets in.
I think one of the things I'd just like to add, you know, there's just been a huge package passed somewhere. I can't remember where. I read it in the paper this morning. About some stimulus money and stuff, and a couple things I noticed in there were roads and improvements and new police officers, and as I understand it, we're getting a lot of new police officers, so I just thought maybe we could make sure we're following up on that somehow. I mean, I don't like to go to the trough, but if we don't, everybody else will. Okay, item 7, please, Sharon.
Contract to retain the services of Pollington Company to provide consulting services for the city's comprehensive plan.
Okay, Jennifer?
Thank you very much. Staff is happy to present our recommendation for consulting services. We recommend that we acquire to lead our comprehensive planning process. The request for qualifications was put out publicly very early in city incorporation. I think it was out there within the first 2 weeks of the city going live. We then had a pre-bid meeting within City Hall that was well attended by about 15 to 18 consulting groups. We then received the packages at a deadline of January 15th. We received 15 bid packages. We pulled through those. 5 of them were disqualified for not meeting the minimum filing requirements. We then took all of the remaining 10 proposals, and we did a staff-level review of a committee within our department of 5 different staff people. We had a great wide variety of experience within our internal staff. We have people that are relatively fresh in their career and are human sponges to the process. We have people like myself that have been doing this for 11 years now, so maybe considered a veteran at this point. And we also have a gentleman on our staff, Jeff Tindler, who you're aware of, who's a former planning director and also a city manager. So we're bringing a lot of experience to the table as we pull through these. We then selected our top 5 that we wanted to bring in for an interview. Of those top 5, 4 attended. We then conducted interviews with the City Hall, met with each consulting team for approximately 45 minutes. They gave a brief presentation, and we asked them questions. In making the short list, price was not the predominant factor in selecting our consulting team. What we did was look at the qualifications of those being proposed on the team, the quality of the sub-consultants, and the quality of experiences that they brought to the table. Price was something definitely considered as a value rather than the bottom dollar. And for consultants that were over the budgeted range, we asked those teams to come to the interview process with an amended scope that would reflect the project that they could do within the city's budget. So at the end of that day, the staff got together. We went around the table, and everybody independently selected their top firm. And it was a unanimous decision from all parties with all of our breadth of experience. So that to me is a sign that it was a very good and thorough process with a lot of different perspectives, but a very solid conclusion. Our recommendation is Pond & Company. They are located out in Norcross. They have a great depth of experience at doing comprehensive plans, but that is not the only thing that they do. They also, they're a multi-disciplined firm of architecture, engineering, and planning. That is very attractive to this process. They also brought some very good consultants and sub-consultants into their group. Arcadis is doing some transportation work in the area, so already has some existing institutional knowledge to say. And then Ross and Associates is the premier group in Georgia for putting together impact fee programs. So they're an excellent expert to have as a part of this team. Another thing Pond brought to the table that I think is unique and very important to what we're going to be doing in the next year is they just completed the comprehensive plan for Shelby's Creek. So not only do they have a lot of experience in comprehensive planning, they have good on-the-ground experience of the unique traits of a startup city. And that is something that I think is going to be very important in the process. So with that, You have a fairly substantial package in front of you. It's a cover memo for myself. There's a contract submitted from Holland. There's also a contract submitted from our city attorney. This is Holland with Megan Barron today. Their first blush is they have no issue with it. There's just a couple points they want to iron out. We should have that complete by Monday whenever it comes to you for a vote. And there's also the full scope of services in their original proposal. One councilman brought to my attention that it says estimated lump sum fee. That is no longer estimated since we were in the contract negotiation process. It is a lump sum fee of $100,000, which is the budget amount. So if any questions, if you have any.
Was Pond & Company one of the companies in which you asked to come back to the table with a reduced price, with a reduced level of services?
No, their original proposal was to $100,000.
Thank you.
I'll just make a couple of points that Jennifer, I think you need to bring up. The spectrum of bids were from where to where?
Our lowest submittal was $80,000. Our highest submittal was $315,000.
Okay. And we have $100,000 budgeted for this in our budget, correct? Everyone? Warren?
Yes, sir.
That is correct? Okay. I will just one statement I would make, not reflective to who we were selecting here or anything else, but comprehensive land use plan, when we put the city in front of the citizens was the number one issue by far of any issue that they were concerned with. And they call it zoning, but of course you have to have a comprehensive land use plan for you on the zoning plan. So the idea of getting down the road and doing this is very important. I think the staff has done a very thorough job. I know price is important, but sometimes quality is also important. So I think you have to balance those the same way we did when we hired the vendors for the city. And to me, I feel that they have done a very good job on the vendors. Robert.
Yeah, just for everybody else's benefit, before I was on the city council, I was asked by the PCID to evaluate vendors to do work with the PCID, and Pond was one of the submittals for that, and they did a fine job. Their proposal for PCID was one of the best, and they are on the PCID's list of preferred engineering firms. So they're doing a lot of work in the area, and the PCID knows them and is happy with them.
I will also submit to everyone that Pond was a bidder as one of the vendors in our proposal. Any other discussion?
Okay. Thank you. I just want to add that you are rated very highly. You get a certification.
Okay, so much for that one. Let's, that one will be on the agenda for the next meeting for everyone's information. Item 8. Karen, can you read that real quick there? Or do you want me to read them? I can read them. You're supposed to read them, I guess.
Discussion of code compliance staffing for community development.
Thank you, members of council. The staff was requested to place an item on the agenda tonight regarding code compliance implementation. And what I've done is actually requested from Clark Patterson Lee, our vendor with community development, to provide us with several options regarding adding staff to the code compliance on a short-term basis to try and address some of our more major problems. So attached to the memorandum is a proposal that shows three considerations ranging from two full-time code compliance staff for 6 months, four part-time staff for 6 months, or four part-time for 6 months, including two additional marked vehicles. Each of the above options provides an additional 8 hours of code compliance, and the prices range from $134,000 for 6 months to $146,000. Two things that I'll say about this. Before I let Jennifer detail those proposals or take questions from me, and Jennifer and I can answer them, maybe is the best way to go. It's the question of how much code enforcement is appropriate. I kind of answer that question the same way that I answer with police services. The more that you have, the better off you're going to be to addressing certain problems that exist. But certainly, in the retreat, when we discussed code compliance, it was very clear to us that the priority was to hit the apartment and commercial areas as the highest priority areas and then take complaints as they come in the single-family residential areas of the city. There's obviously significant issues within the apartment areas. The way that we are structured currently, which is innovative, and it's yet to be determined whether it'll be effective, is that the building inspectors that the city has hired through Clark Patterson Lee also perform code enforcement, so they do a double task. And that certainly limits their ability to be proactive in code enforcement, being that they're not a dedicated resource. Certainly, one of the challenges we've had in the first few months of implementation is taking transfer permits from DeKalb County, which obviously exceeds the volume that we would get on a normal basis, normal ongoing basis. So those inspections after the moratorium were lifted is what we've been focusing on. And I will take any questions or comments that y'all may have. We are looking more for direction from y'all as to how you want us to go about it, anything on this. Jennifer and I are available to answer questions you may have.
Jennifer, do you mind just sort of counsel that a bit to repeat the conversation you had with Danny and I today at the office, kind of what the situation is with the inspectors slash code enforcement folks and what the utilization is, just so that we can...
Certainly. For a little bit of perspective, we've been open for business for 3 weeks, so it's hard to tell you what normal is going to be and what the usual flow is going to be. We're still getting a handle of that on ourselves. Our staffing level up until today was a chief inspector and a building inspector that were also both serving in the code compliance roles. Warren's absolutely correct in that we found, once we opened for business, we have had a flood of inspection requests. We've had probably 2 days out of 3 weeks where we've had less than 100 inspection requests per day. So we've been very busy with inspections. So the reality of that situation is it's really hard to tell somebody, I'm sorry, I can't get to your inspection today because I need to devote my 20 hours to code compliance. So inspections has been the dominant effort of those two employees. To that end, we had an additional inspector start today. So we now have 3 people performing the task of inspection and code compliance. Our goal at this point is to have one person focused full-time on inspections, one person focused full-time on code compliance, and then our chief will administer the administrative function of plan review and then also float between the two functions as needed.
I guess what we're looking for here is, I just think, with the amount of inspections, they've not been able to do a level of code enforcement. In some of the areas, I know we're waiting for the police to come up because there's a few areas where you really don't want those folks in alone right now.
May I address that?
Sure.
I just want to make sure that's put out there the right way. We are actively working with the apartment complexes, most particularly the apartment complexes located near Peachtree Industrial Boulevard. We made contact with them, I think, the first day we were open, and they have been responsive to us, but it's just pushing a rock up a mountain. I mean, there's so many things that need to be addressed there. They can only do so much at once. So the major thing we have there is a presence. We have a daily presence reminding them that we're watching, we expect changes, and although they may come slowly, they are coming. We're planning to implement an apartment sweeps program similar to the Sandy Springs model. And the true benefit of that is you swarm a property and you hit them with a comprehensive list of everything that needs to happen. But in order to do that, in my opinion, you need to show up at the fire marshal's office because then you're addressing all of the life safety codes at one time. And again, you get a comprehensive list and then you don't have a complaint against you that you're picking at the issue. You're addressing it, you're cleaning it up, and you're moving on and checking back to make sure things maintain. As you guys are well aware, a couple of those apartment complexes on that side of town have a lot of gang activity, and I've been very direct with the guys in our department of, we are a civilian force. If there's ever a moment where you feel you need to leave the property, you are correct. You need to leave the property. So I feel from a staffing and responsibility perspective, before we are doing a sweep of a property, I'd like to have a police force in effect because those can be confrontational situations, and there's an interesting mix of people.
Well, I agree with you 100%, and the council's 100% behind that. We're not putting any of our people at risk. That's
End of story.
Well, we're putting his people at risk. But they carry guns.
I think a couple things here. And number one has to do with finance. We're hearing about a lot of expenses here. And we do not have the endless pot here in finances. And one of the things I addressed to Jennifer today, I'll repeat it, is that, you know, if we put forth this on the street, would we have code violations, fines, et cetera, to cover that? And she said, there's no assurance that I can say that or not. So, and I understand that. But I think one of the other things, they are cross-training there. We do have, I think, half a more code compliance person than we had with DeKalb County, so we do have more. We have told the citizens all along that when we start up here, there'll be a gradual improvement. We will not be able to correct all the hills overnight. So I think that's one of the things we have to have is a little patience here. And I understand where some of the council is coming from. I fully understand that because I've been over there and taken a look at some of this. But I think adding additional code enforcement until we have our own police force, I think is kind of counterproductive, one of the things. And the other thing I would just bring out to you is that, again, getting back to the budget, this first year, there's some uncertainties in the budget, and especially with today's economy. We need to keep our purse strings pretty tight. Squeeze the nickel. Remember the line. One of the other things I asked Jennifer today is there another option? Like, could we get two part-time people with 20 hours in one vehicle? And she went back and talked to Kevin, the CPL, for everybody's information. They have a CPL. And they came back and said, yes, we could do that, and that 139 figure on option one would go to 69. But I think until we get our own police force up and running, I think where we are is what we need to be, and then we need to revisit this. I know the city manager is going to do like a 6-month review in June to see where we are, the finances and all the world then. Maybe we'll have a better idea of exactly where we stand financially and what we can do before we start, tossing the money around like it's growing on trees.
Robert?
I agree with the essence of what you've said. It's way too early for us to start adding unbudgeted expenses above and beyond the ones that we've already been encountered. But I must say, the other thing that occurred to me as I read through this is that it seemed very pricey for what we were getting. $139,000 to essentially add one FTE with a car. I looked at the salary ranges for DeKalb County for their code enforcement officers. What they've got is $139,000 for two people for half a year. So I'm extrapolating to say that would be $139,000 is the cost for a head per year, right? So code enforcement officers in DeKalb don't make very much. We might pay them a little better than that, but we could get. This strikes me as feeling like a big markup. You pay somebody $30,000 or $40,000 a year to be a code enforcement officer, and you get them a car, and you could get two people for what a CPL is talking about getting one. And we don't want to go adding a lot of city employees because there's other costs associated with that, and there's a lack of flexibility. But $139,000 seemed like a lot for one basically worker bee level position.
Jeff?
I have a couple points. Transfer permits. You mentioned that they're very large right now, that you're doing an awful lot of them. When do you see the number of transfer permits coming from DeKalb that Dunwoody's going to be doing? Do we have any idea when those are slowing down, or are they already slowing down?
Yes, obviously our flood was the first week and a half. We're now starting week 3 tomorrow. There was, most particularly, an apartment complex that was mid-construction that we've been transferring those permits over, but they've kind of flushed through the system, and now we're getting a lot more new permitting activity. When we're going to be done, it's kind of hard to say, because particularly in this economic climate, A lot of people are just waiting a little bit longer to pull the trigger on things. They may have been raring to go in September, and now they're kind of holding tight to see what happens. I think the basic break point is going to be that your permit's good for 6 months, and once there's no level of activity for 6 months, you have to re-up for a new permit, and that would be considered a new permit within our system. So I think the safe rule of thumb is within 6 months, we should have flushed most everything that was in the system.
Okay, so we'll know better soon.
Yes.
I'm also, in case you don't know, there's a metrics guy. I want to know where we are, how many hours, how many things are being done. We don't have the website up or a tracking system. Do we have a tracking system right now as far as complaints being generated?
Yes, we've had our Community Development Partners Program, which is our issuance, our management system, our code compliance system, has been available in-house for about a week and a half. So we are putting information into that, and we'll be able to generate reports on demand from here on out once the data's in the system. There were a couple things that we inherited from DeKalb County that we're also going back and working on. Most specifically, there was a list of about 50 items that was forwarded to us from the Code Enforcement Division of DeKalb County. We are making our way through that list and making contact with, for those that did list, who made the complaint, we're making contact with those people to see if their issue has been resolved or whether they'd like to reactivate their complaint. And again, we're also spending a significant amount of time at two apartment complexes over on Peachtree Industrial, and we have made a good bit of progress with them. I do have some examples with me tonight if anybody's curious after the fact. We sent them letters including photographs showing, you know, this is exactly what's wrong and this is what you need to do to fix it. About half of these lists are either checked off as complete, and it's dealing with major quality of life issues, like major rat infestation, where one complex has spent about $5,000 just on extermination fees so far, siding rotting off the side of the building, they've got carpenters out there every day working away at it, there's swimming pools that were in a terrible state, they've been drained and cleaned out, so we're making progress. It's, as I said, it's just pushing uphill.
Well, thank you for setting the priorities, but I'm also wondering, what's the backlog? How many do you have in waiting that currently citizens have complained about? I want to make sure that we fund what you need, but I want to know what you need.
We're just kind of ramping up into that phase where people know we're here. Our code compliance information just went live on the website about a week ago, so that's generated a good bit more activity because people now know who to call, where to call, name, phone number, things like that. So we're getting a couple complaints a day. We are responding to those complaints within a day or two at the max of receiving them. But it's a very laborious task, and that's one of the challenges of code compliance, is a lot of the time it's not hard, it just takes a lot of time to chase these problems, and then when you make first contact with whatever, when you receive the call, you're having a conversation there, you're then doing some research in the office to make sure you actually have a violation and not just a complaint about the way the world is. We then go out to the site, we make contact with that property owner, that sometimes takes a couple attempts, and then we start the education process to bring it in.
And I understand that you're doing the education process right now. You're probably still in that phase. Has anybody been cited whereby they're going to be showing up at court?
We have not issued any citations.
So you have not issued any citations as of yet?
We've received 8 complaints in the 3 weeks we've been open that were generated in the last 3 weeks, not inherited from some other problem.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Any more discussion? Thank you very much, Jennifer. Be brief. Appreciate it. Okay. Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, let's talk about C9. Here are the parts.
Chair, can I?
I'm sorry. Oh. Well, it's a discussion of the ordinance to grant franchise agreement for Atlantic Gas and Light. Warren, you got it.
Is this a, this not the first redoing occurring, is that correct? members of council, at the February 9th meeting, we were asked questions to research the initial budgetary estimate for the AGL franchise fee payment. $260,656 is what we anticipated. The franchise fee ordinance you're discussing has an estimated fee for 2009 of $332,071. This results in the unexpected revenue of about $71,450.
like to point out that's good financial news.
Yeah.
Woohoo!
I'll put a star on that one.
Okay. Does anybody have any discussion on that issue?
I've got one other issue that's not in here.
Okay.
Last council meeting, there were two items that were requested to add to this. One is the payment schedule, and the other is the concession to Comcast to raise the rate back in. That has been added. It wasn't added by Wednesday when this came out. It's sent to me. We haven't heard back. But those two issues have been incorporated in the current draft. Comcast language inserted into the AGL contract.
Yes, that was my question.
So the only two changes that have been made.
Okay, and we'll get a new draft before we have to vote on it.
Yes,
right.
Okay. Hopefully.
Brian, just a point of order on that. Have they agreed to do that?
No.
No. So we're just going to add it to it, and
we have actually sent it, but we've not heard back.
Okay. We had any discussions with them about adding it yet?
No. I don't expect it to be a problem. Usually, what has happened in the last, I just email it to them. A couple days later, they say that's fine. It gets counter language. I expect that to be the case this time.
Think we'll be able to have this done by next Monday night?
Probably, but I can't guarantee it. If not, it will be on the agenda.
Can you refresh for us the payment schedule you talked about? Is that the monthly in arrears as opposed to quarterly in arrears language?
And what I added in was quarterly in arrears.
So it's stated quarterly in arrears?
There was no time. You weren't here last meeting. There was no time just to refresh.
There was no time.
Because we had asked the Comcast specifically to put it, give it to us on a monthly basis, not quarter in arrears.
Yeah, this one I just put into a
little agreed to.
I mean, if you want to do it, I can send another email asking you to ask for monthly. Easy enough to be done.
Well, we pay it, don't we? It's our money.
I'll go ahead and make that change.
Comcast is...
We can always fall back on quarterly. Yeah.
Well, no, Comcast is agreed to do it.
That's correct. And Comcast agreed to
it. They should agree to do it as well. That's what I was going to ask. That's what I like.
Okay. Any other questions? Any other discussion on that? Have we beaten that one around enough? Okay. Warren, you're up for number 10. Voice and status real quick.
Thank you. This is directed by Town Council. Monthly update. Public contract status. January 2009 bill was $67,369. Cumulative cost as of January 2009 is $348,179. The two projects that important personnel are currently helping with is the City Hall build-out and a compilation of policies and procedures. And I do want to point out, because they have been unclear in previous communications, that for the policies and procedures, they're not actually drawing the actual policies and procedures, but the system of compiling existing policies and procedures that our staff is put together where we found as best practices and putting it into one document that will make good sense. We plan on coming to you with the first six of the policies, I believe is going to be from next Monday's meeting. Purchasing policy will be one of those policies coming forward.
If you can give us a couple of days extra. It sounds like we've got a lot of reading to do. If you could give us any extra time on that, it'd be greatly appreciated.
Is that a first read then, or would we be voting?
We can also hold that until March, if that would be...
No, just give them to us.
Okay. As soon as we have them, the final form.
Well, I've got one point. You know, the figure, the cumulative figure is a little ambiguous to the fact that, you know, we had... there was amount for services, and then there was an amount that we paid that Boykin International paid for, i.e. salaries and things like that, that we didn't have money for until the first of the year. I think it would be kind of advantageous for the council to have that broken out separately and say, you know, of that $348,000, I think it was $281,000, I think it was the first figure up through the end of the year, that, you know, 200 and whatever it is, XX was for services to Boykin, and the other one was for repayment of
money that was forwarded for expenses.
Yeah, we can break out for you the fees versus the marked up expenses.
Thank you.
That's great idea.
Okay.
Does anybody have anything else?
I guess going down the road, the future, are we reducing this cost considerably? Like, will February be considerably less than January?
I don't know at this point, because we're certainly heating up on the build-out issues. That will plane off at some point as we get further into the construction. So the planning and final scoping of that project certainly taking a number of hours, but we will keep a careful eye on it, trying to draw down as many, as few hours as possible.
Good. I think that's very important.
Okay. Anybody else?
Okay, item 11, city manager's update. City manager standing there.
Thank you, Ben. Members of council have asked me specifically to address four items tonight to you at this meeting. So four items that have been requested and discussed are the Mack Road improvement plan, update on our city website, update on city clerk's role as the ordinance repository, and budget update and revenue projections. I do have some staff here that will help me on some of the specifics. You have questions, but I'll just summarily update you on the Womack Road improvement plans. Richard, our public works director, did meet with the transportation committee for the new 405 Academy, and he has given the notes from that meeting that are in your memorandum. And I think the key to take home for me is that Richard is intimately involved with the committee and the plans that are ongoing for decel lanes and striping, and that he's staying on top of that. And certainly the details are in the memorandum, but I'm not going to read them to you at this point. But it is certainly a good line of communication is open. He's working very effectively with them to make sure that we do have our plans in place. One note I will make is that the committee is also wanting to look at a signal, traffic signal for that entrance, and I think Richard correctly recommended to the committee that we wait on the signal installation until we have some actual traffic figures to determine a more realistic warrant for that intersection than just go ahead and putting it up in anticipation of a certain work. But once the traffic signal's up, it ain't coming down. So I think that makes a lot of sense. On the website, update, the good news here is the website is substantially complete. We expect to go live by the end of this month with the new website. The actual website was ready to go live, and I've held it because two modules that I promised the council were not ready on time. At the time, they were ready to go live with the general website. And those two modules are the discussion board and the service request feature, which I think are monumentally important to what we're trying to accomplish from a community interaction standpoint, and also a customer service standpoint. So those two modules are in production right now, and we're looking at the most cost-efficient way to do both of those through third-party vendors as opposed to doing the R&D in-house and paying for that on an hourly basis. So there's certainly very good modules that are already out there that we can incorporate into our site. So we are finishing those up. We've got all the photos taken, the bios, all the information has been put into the new site design. I think y'all will be extremely impressed with the work that's been done on that. The website will be something to be very proud of. The content management system behind it, which is really the most important part of the backbone, is state-of-the-art. And we're very excited about the ease in which we'll be able to update information with in-house instead of depending on sending everything to Florida for uploading. Yes, sir.
Will folks be able to pay fines online to the website?
Not initially, but yes, they will. We'll have that integration put in. What we're waiting for ultimately is to have the software vendor selected for our court software, and then also making sure that we have the compatibility to our financial management software. So that would be my estimate, probably within the next 6 months, we'll have that functionality in place, and then long term, we're hoping from an e-services standpoint to also be able to pay for building permits, business licenses, anything that you would otherwise have to either send us a certified check or come in to pay for, we'll be able to take online. So that's our goal. But it's going to take a little while to get up to speed on that, because all the applications that we have online pay have to back into some sort of internal system, and our internal systems at this point are a little vacant. The update on the ordinance repository is my understanding from the city clerk that we are now in possession of all the ordinances, resolutions, and contracts that we passed. We got those from the interim clerk from Johns Creek. Not only encouraging, but mandating on a staff basis that any contracts or any other agreements that we're entering into, that Sharon has given the original, and she'll be the holder of those. Additionally, we've worked into the new building in Perimeter Center East a separate file room, which will be secured, and also have a gas suppression system on it that will protect all the original documents. So I think we're in great shape, so I think we have an expert city clerk on hand to be able to handle it.
We talked about starting to feed this stuff into MuniCode. How far away are we from being able to begin to do that?
Let me get back with you. We probably need to talk with the MuniCode folks to find out if we're doing that. I think it would be fairly simple, because the ordinances are in form and there's no book to supplement. There's the budget update revenue projections, and I did recently advise the council by email that we're in the final stages of creating a format for the monthly financial report, which will include the actual data. We expect to have that to you by the 23rd of February, and then also post that on our website to try and provide some financial transparency. We're also going to be providing the necessary budget amendments and having the memorandum marked. We move that up to next week, so we'll have a comprehensive budget amendment for you at that point to discuss along with our current financial position. There's been no major surprises so far on the revenue side. I know that the one question I've gotten from a couple council members, the alcohol that was collected came in, I think, within like $5 of our budget. So we did an excellent job on that. The business license revenue doesn't come in until deadline is not until March 15th, so we don't expect the sum of that to be coming in close to that point. But I mean, John and I would be much more prepared to give you a comprehensive look at the financials come next week when we give you the financial report. Also, from an expectation standpoint, what we anticipate doing through the end of this year is providing you with a monthly financial report, and then in 2010, moving that to a quarterly. We'll have an internal basis of monthly reporting of the revenue and expenses and other indicators. But what we found from experience is that a quarterly reporting mechanism to council is actually more effective, because from a trend standpoint, it's very difficult to determine usefulness of some of the financial data on a monthly basis. So we'll make it available to you, but we'll make the presentations of the data on a quarterly basis, except I think it'll be more meaningful. But throughout 2009, it'll be monthly. Be happy to answer any questions you want to have.
John? Start back at the Womack Road. I passed out a quick mock-up of the street location. Maybe one for you, Richard. As you're looking at the map, you said about the signal. I'm taking for granted that the signal would be located adjacent to Lakeland
yes.
For the parent drop-off?
Yes. The proposal from the school is that the Lakeland entrance, or the entrance that lines up with Lakeland, would be the parent and public entrance, and the other entrance is bus only.
Correct. And can you tell us about the D-cell lane? There's a possibility of that D-cell lane going away due to the sight lines and basically a safety hazard?
Yes. When we were, one of the things that we met, we met with the committee actually on site. And one of the things I noticed when standing, and this is my first opportunity to visit the school site and actually see what the conditions were out there. When we were standing in the driveway, if you're standing at the driveway looking up Womack back towards the high school, you're going up a hill and there's a little crest right there. There's also the embankment on the side of the road is such that there's an embankment right on the side of the road that kind of tails off when you get to the property line. But when you're sitting in this driveway, you could not see cars coming from over the hill on Womack Road. And one of the concerns was when we were discussing, one of the things we're going to be striping in is placement of handicap ramps and a crosswalk across this driveway. And with the decel lane, that pushes that whole crosswalk back 12 feet, which makes it, you put the stop bar back so far from Womack Road that it's going to be almost impossible to see cars coming from coming up from Womack Road to get in and out. For the speed on that road, for the length of that decel lane almost serves no purpose anyway. It doesn't. It's not long enough to be an effective storage lane. It's so short, and the speed of at least the supposed to speed limit on the road is such that it's not long enough to really serve as a decel lane. And my recommendation is that the decel lane itself be taken out and the curb tied directly to the existing curb line on Womack. That would allow us to move the crosswalk and the stop bar up. We also discussed some potential. The school is supposed to present DHA I believe it's gone through DHA with a landscape plan for this frontage along the school. And part of that we discussed is needs to show some treatment of that embankment to pull that embankment back. It looks like all the grading that would have to be done is on the school property or in the right-of-way. It does not appear that it would encroach onto that private property, although that's something that when we get a detailed plan, we would have to look at and see if the school would have to do some potential acquisition with that property owner for easements to grade that back. But between a combination of moving the crosswalk, the stop bar up, and pulling back the embankment, we should be able to get the site distance we need there.
And something else to think of is the fact that based on where the students are located, it's basically all the schools in Dunwoody except for Kingsley. Therefore, leaving, when you look at the map, coming out of that driveway, most students would be turning left.
That's the feeling I got from the transportation committee, that there'd be, the predominant traffic will be left, that turning left out of that driveway, not right.
There's a resident in the audience, Mike Smith, who lives on Old Village Mill Lane, which is actually two streets over. It's a cut-through street. Mike's neighborhood asked for a traffic assessment and possible traffic calming on his streets through DeKalb County. That assessment was stalled, broken into three pieces, almost went through 2 months ago, and then was tabled. Dunwoody's now in existence. This neighborhood now has to come back to us.
Yes.
Could you please take a look or contact DeKalb County to see what work has been done on Old Village Lane and Village Creek and the adjacent streets to see if the traffic study's already been done?
Mm-hmm.
Let's not reinvent the wheel. I have an idea that these residents are going to be inundated with cut-through traffic because of the new school. And I would want to make sure that we're ready for their application if they decide to go forward.
Yes, I will go ahead and contact the county, get that information.
Last thing on the school. We're not in control of bus transportation, but it's the one thing that's going to feed into our transportation needs when it comes to the school.
Yes.
There's a policy put in place, a proposal, I guess, I'm not sure if it's final, that busing will only be available to students greater than 1.5 miles away from the school. 1.5 miles away from the school, as the bird flies, is a rather large area. I believe that's not going to be as the bird flies, but via ground distance.
I believe the interpreter, I've read that, I went back and read that. It's a 1.5 mile walking distance is the way it reads. My interpretation of that is that's actual routing distance. So no child is supposed to be have to walk more than 1.5 miles.
If there was any way in which we could work with the school system to try to get that up, I mean, we're trying to fix the roads, but the transportation, the busing of these students is really going to directly affect the entire Dunwoody area.
And one of the other concerns in meeting with the transportation committee was over the busing schedule at that school as well. because the way the busing schedule was set up is, and again, we don't have control of the busing schedule, it's the school function, is that those elementary school students will be picked up as early as 6:30 in the morning and have to be dropped at the school as much as 45 minutes before school started, which in it itself is going to mean that very few students, very few parents are going to put their kids on that school bus that early and have them sit there, that they're going to be obviously driving them, which is going to increase the amount of vehicle traffic. And that was a concern that the parents on the transportation committee had as well for that.
That's all I have on Womack Road. Thank you.
Okay. Is there any way to keep that deceleration lane in there? I think that's Casey back there. I bumped the deceleration as well as that crosswalk you talked about. I know that mound exists because I moved that myself. But, you know, the best case, you'd want to have both of those in there. You know, you're taking out something that I think it is part of the safety here. Is there any way to make that grade such as, I know there's a mound there that it really is.
We'd have to, I can look at that and evaluate. I have to get plans from the school to evaluate whether we can. One of these things with these short deceleration lanes is there really a safety factor in there? One of the things I look at, sometimes it actually can lead to more speeding rather than reducing the speeding on the road. And is it really being functioning like it's supposed to, or is it just additional pavement out there that gives, is it just additional pavement that's not really necessary? Is it really functioning the way it's supposed to as a safety feature? And normally on a road like this, that deceleration is so short, I don't know that you have to do most of your deceleration in the through lane before you get into the deceleration lane, so I don't know that it's really functioning as a true deceleration lane because of its length.
The landscaping plans are supposed to be done in April.
Yes.
I've met with Robin Burse and Pat Polk, and they're supposed to be given to us in April.
Yes.
And they're supposed to be fairly extensive.
Yes.
I think one of the other things here that I was happened to be there the day Richard was there, just happened to go by, and I stopped to talk to him, and one of the things there is the possibility, Richard, tell me where that's at, about taking the 25-mile-an-hour zone all the way back up maybe to Dunwoody High School, because people coming over that crest of that hill have a tendency to get it on coming down the speed there.
One thing, and we haven't done a full evaluation yet, obviously there will be a school speed limit zone of 25-mile-an-hour. One of the things we have to evaluate is the distances, the state-mandated distances that allow that, whether there's in... The potential is that if there's an overlap between the Dunwoody High School district and this district, obviously you merge it into one district. Although there was even feeling there to maybe you leave it as separate districts, because then you have that additional set of flashers at the top of the hill that kind of reinforces, even though technically you're going in from an enforcement issue with the police, you're going out of the school speed zone for a little bit, having the two sets of flashers there might be more effective. Even if you have a small gap of 35 mile an hour in between them, to reinforce that you still are in speeds in the school zone.
You'd also have two different times. The high school starts much later versus the elementary school. I don't know if that's an enforcement problem or not.
I don't believe so, because if you look at Chestnut Elementary and Peachtree Middle School, that's essentially one flasher zone that just extends the whole time. You just extend the time period. That the and I would use that example of the middle school at Chestnut Elementary as what we would end up doing here.
I was just thinking they might be so far apart that there'd be
Actually, the schedule I see for school start times are not that far apart. The bus times are that far apart, the school starts time is not that far apart.
Thank you. A couple of questions. First of all, along with Councilman Ross, I'm concerned about the deceleration lane, and mostly what I'm concerned about is cars backing up at pickup at the end of the day. As somebody who lives right next to Austin, there's a half an hour where you simply can't get by because the cars are just stopped on Roberts Drive, and if you need to go north, you're out of luck.
that's, I mean, to some degree, I worry about creating that position, that situation here, a pickup at the end of the day. Do we know how many cars are going to be able to be in that carpool line before it backs up onto Womack?
I have to get, I think the school knows. I don't have that information on hand from the school. I will say with that deep acceleration lane, you maybe could fit three cars in there before it's going to extend out into Womack. So for the if it's going to be a case of less than three cars, yes, but chances are there's going to be more than, if it extends out onto the roadway, you're going to have more than three vehicles, which means it's going to back up onto the through lanes of Womack, whether the descent lane is there or not.
My other question is that based on what we know now, do we have a better idea of what it's going to cost the city to do in 2009 to prepare for the school? In other words, one of the real unknowns for us coming into this was whether we needed $100,000 or $500,000 or $1 million.
Right.
This looks pretty simple to me.
My evaluation is that we haven't come up with exact, we're still working on coming up with cost figures because we're still working on the plans on this. But because Womack Road is already wide enough, we can stripe, it's wide enough to be able to stripe in a center turn lane for left turns in without having to widen the pavement that's there and do any reconstruction. So what we're basically looking at is the cost of restriping on Womack Road. And what we're going to look at is a plan that goes from Tilling Mill up to Vermack and kind of incorporate everything in there as well to make sure that we're not just doing this. We're going to look at that whole stretch to see what we can do from a restriping standpoint. The cost of the school flashers would have to be in there. But those are about the only two items, and maybe some small sidewalk patches to make sure the sidewalk connectivity is granted.
I just a point here. I think, I don't know how it can work or anything, but, you sit here and you plan out, and you think, well, okay, everybody gets a number usually. You know, you got a disc or something on the front of their car. I'm just wondering if you can't space out the picking up of the students just a little bit there, and rather than everybody hit it at once, like one through however many holes, this hole 60 or 50 gets picked up at closing, school out plus three, and then 5 minutes later, the next group, or 10 minutes later. I think they can kind of enhance and work with us on something like that. If everybody shows up at the same time, it's going to be like where Robert and I live. There's not going to be any movement there whatsoever. I think cost, Robert, Councilman Wittenstein brought up a great idea. Right here I get cost. What is the possibility? I know one other time somebody said that's all ours. What is the possibility of some matching funds from the state or the federal government or somewhere, I'm not going to say the county because I don't want anybody to laugh at me, but I mean, what is the possibility of coming up with some matching funds for this? This is a new school. It seems like somewhere there should be written in some tiny little print that there's something there for people who are starting a new school or something.
In fact, please.
My experience with this is that the school, I think it's in state law that the schools are exempt from making some improvements, and they have interpreted that to mean making no improvements to the public rights of way. So there's no money from the school. As far as matching funds, we can look into it. I don't think there is any programs that provide for this. I do know from other counties that they basically have to spend, that are doing a lot more school expansion. They spend practically their whole budget doing nothing but school traffic projects. They budget extensive amounts for it. I know Gwinnett County is that way. Most of their budget goes for school projects, just for the amount of school expansion they're doing. So.
You know, I just have a question about whether it would be possible we get state money because we have the state college government.
Potentially, in one of the things we're looking at is DeKalb County had talked to the Perimeter College. I haven't personally talked with them yet, but Perimeter College was looking at potentially putting some money up front for restriping. in front of their school, but towards restructuring the Womack Road itself, so there's a potential source that we could get money from the college itself to assist with the Womack Road restructuring.
Ken, we're talking about a traffic light at the parent drop-off, and we're going to do an assessment to see where we are on that. As far as costs, what if we find out very quickly that we do need a light? And what happens if we can't put a light and we want to put in some type of law enforcement or some type of traffic control person at that location? Who would have to pay for that? How would we do it? And would that be in our budget?
I believe, based on the discussion with the school is required, the school system is required to have a crossing guard at that location. And there will be one of the items that will be put in there is a crosswalk across Womack Road from the sidewalk on the Lakeland side over to the sidewalk on the school side. Right. And so they will be mandated to provide a crossing guard at that location. That crossing guard does not necessarily have full traffic control direction. I'm not on that side of it. So if we wanted to have a law enforcement officer on there, that would have to be something we work out with the school, whether it be the school paid for it, whether the city pays for it, we'll have to work that out with them.
The school has to provide, or the county has to provide a crossing guard, but we're responsible providing police to direct traffic.
Okay. And if I could...
We don't have any police to direct the traffic in any other school.
Yeah, just asking a question.
On the signal, to answer your question on the signal, depending on the aesthetic quality of the signal, whether we go stand wire or mast arm, you could be anywhere from $80,000 to $150,000. Obviously, mast arm decorative poles will be more expensive. Span wire, you would go towards the lower end of that. It would not, by the nature of it, it would be, as signals go, an expensive signal compared to other signals, but some of that gets to be the aesthetic quality that gets band-aided into any traffic signal that gets put there.
I just have one final question regarding both 2 and 3, the website and the ordinance repository. I take it for granted that our website will have the current final regulations and everything that we've passed, one main place to where we can find it. If we don't have it on MuniCode, at least we could have all the chapters in order, basically the final versions of everything. Thank you.
I just want to commend the staff on getting this thing up and running. You know, I mean, we've lived here for how many years? We've got very little response, replies, or anything else from those who were taking their tax dollars, and now we've got somebody that's responding to us, and I think that's why we voted for the city. The last thing I would just like to ask you a question on, Warren, is I asked you a while ago, maybe I hit you a little late on this one, but is the home inspection updates, the requirement to notify DeKalb County of cessation of police protection on 1 April or 31 March in this case.
We anticipate at the conclusion of this month, obviously prior to, we're going to provide DeKalb County with notice to terminate the contract for police services. We don't anticipate anything stopping us from being able to provide police services come April 1.
I just want to make sure we get them notified. And the last thing on the...
It's on the list. $430,000 thing on the list.
You have to be online, too. And the home exemption updates, can you tell me, basically how many that we've got in? I have this terrible fear, and we're, ladies and gentlemen, a jury less than 2 weeks away from everybody having to have to have their application in. I've got this terrible fear that we've just got a lot of citizens that have not applied.
I can address that. The deadline of March 1st is not a hard and fast deadline. Because the city is recognizing the cap. If you file the application with the cap, from our perspective, we're going to give the exemption. If it's not filed with the cap, regardless of whether or not they file it with the city, from a precautionary measure, we're asking that all of the homeowners file with the city as well. As in the event of the most unlikely challenge to the exemption from a lawsuit in terms of the city, that would possibly challenge the validity of the exemptions that we're providing. There is, from a legal standpoint, I've been advised there's a fairly significant argument in our favor that those exemptions that were provided to DeKalb County are valid. There's an alternate legal opinion that says that maybe they're not. So that's the reason we're in this game to start with. So I'm unconcerned that if someone doesn't file by March 1st, it will not prevent them from getting their exemption as long as they already have it filed with DeKalb County. We're going to honor it. So we're going to continue to encourage folks to submit to us. Certainly we've been flooded with applications. I noticed this latest crier, we also have the application actually printed into the newspaper, in addition to the other viral ways that we've been spreading the word on the applications. We've received approximately 4,200 applications so far that we've processed and filed. They're still flooding in daily, and I expect that will continue. And I would be surprised if we didn't end up with approximately 10,000 applications by the end of the spring. And hopefully, over the course of time, we'll be able to hit all the rest of them and get the 14,000 or so that are due to us. But I think the likelihood of a lawsuit challenging us is remote at best.
If a resident is filing for the first time, and he files through DeKalb to Dunwoody, I mean, do we differentiate that filing? I mean, if the person hadn't filed with DeKalb County before, but he's using that as his vehicle for filing. How do we make sure he gets put into the system?
If they file with the city of Dunwoody, when we do our billing, which will be hopefully through the tax commissioner's office, that information will be presented to them so that they know that home will have an exemption. Likely anyone that applies with the city of Dunwoody will also apply with DeKalb County, and we're advising folks that they need to file two separate applications if they're a first-time applicant for the exemption. So to be qualified for it, they're going to have to apply in both places to get both exemptions.
Any more questions, Warren?
Yeah. Danny and I met today with the general managers of three of Dunwoody's large hotels, the Marriott, the Embassy Suites, and the Crown Plaza, and they indicated that their business has dropped off much faster, much harder than they would have guessed even 2 months ago. And one of the things we may want to do is to look back at our hotel motel tax revenue and make sure we haven't overestimated that. They think they're down 20% from where they were just two, three months ago.
Sure. And I can tell you, the initial, we've gotten the first payments.
Yeah, right. First payments we're doing January.
Which will show up on your January financials, and I've seen the estimates that we gave, we actually exceeded those considerably.
Okay.
And that was only three of the hotels paid out of the four.
Out of five.
By that, four out of five had paid. So we were actually missing an entire hotel, and we had exceeded our expectations considerably. Whether or not, that was just because it was based on that time period, and then it's going to decline from here forward. That's certainly something we're going to track very carefully to make sure that we're on top of. Obviously, the 3% portion of it is the part that we're most concerned with, because that feeds into our general fund revenue expectations. The additional percentage that goes into the hotel tax fund, that obviously we're making an error on. We haven't, for this year, really targeted anything in spending. I'd be a little less concerned with that portion of it, but they're all related in that it's one source of revenue, so it's certainly something John's tracking very carefully and will continue to track very carefully.
Last year, to that point, they did $46 million in the hotels they have this year. $46 million, I'm sorry. This year, they expect the number's going to be probably $37
million. Okay. And did we call the hotel that didn't send it in?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes,
right. It would be the W. We could guess that the hotel that didn't send it in would be the W. So.
I actually don't know.
Yeah, right. They don't have a general manager, so they're between general managers. It would make sense.
I can certainly assure you that we've gone through the progression of nice phone calls and visits to
good.
Nancy letters eventually.
Good.
Good.
Their homestead exemption, the covenant applied for, their property tax freeze.
And they, do they need to do that with the city of Dunwoody only, or do they also have to apply with the capital?
John, what
was the question?
The assessment freeze?
Yeah. What about the freeze?
It's their first time applying for it. Can they just apply through the city of Dunwoody? How would they do it?
Okay. It's the same thing as the homestead exemptions. It applies to both the county and the city, so they need to apply for both.
Okay.
There's one exception to that, and that would be the over 70 school tax exemption.
Okay. Anything else for Warren?
Okay. Entertain the motion to go into executive session.
Public comment?
Public comment.
Point of privilege?
Yes.
I'd like to thank Mr. Mike Smith for being the only person here that doesn't have to be paid.
Tom's getting paid. Tom's paid to be here. Mike is the only guy who's not getting paid to sit here.
Happy to be here and happy to hear the concern. Thank you very much.
Thank you. You get the late night aisle award. We'll send it out to you.
I don't, but I want to get you my information tomorrow.
Yeah. Okay, let me get back to the ground we're in. And let's go into public comment. Are there any public comment cards?
Public comment. Okay. I've got a comment. I'm going to have to take
a I move we go into executive session.
Second.
Okay, all in favor?
Aye.
Okay.